What I know is that one of the greatest strengths of this country is that we do not have classes of citizenship. All citizens have the same rights and privileges. And that was certainly not my experience at the airport. So for whatever reason it was, whether I was targeted for my civil rights advocacy or based on the color of my skin and my identity, it's unconstitutional and un-American.
And Hassan Aden, you're familiar with databases that law enforcement use as a former police chief. What database do you think you're in?
I'm not sure. I do think that I believe I was never told that by CBP, but I believe it's some sort of what I was told was that my name was used as an alias and that some database flagged it. So I believe it's something to do with a terrorist watch list or a fusion center. But what I do know is that one of three things is going on with this database. One, either the database is—
We have 5 seconds.
There's a problem with the database and the policies behind it. It should not take 90 minutes to clear someone holding a U.S. passport.
Hassan Aden, former chief of police of Greenville, North Carolina, detained at JFK. Ivan Espinoza-Madrigal, with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and Economic Justice, detained at Logan Airport in Boston. That does it for our broadcast. Happy birthday to Miriam Barnard. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
I think everyone should just kind of keep their eyes peeled to how much these nominees continue to try to separate themselves in some ways from the president who nominated them.
I think climate change, which has been a huge priority for President Obama at the EPA, I think you'll see that all but disappear.
The incoming president is a loose cannon, to put it mildly, and we can't know for certain what his administration will do.
I'm Jesse Lent, host of Trump Watch Countdown to Inauguration on WBAI. For the last 6 weeks, we've examined how our lives could change under the incoming administration. Now, with the inauguration of Donald J. Trump soon upon us, we'll be continuing our coverage of this new era of American politics in our regular time slot. Join me Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. when Trump Watch Countdown to Inauguration will become Trump Watch the First 100 Days on WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio in New York.
Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Thank each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
And you are listening to radio station WBAI in New York. The time is 8 o'clock, and we know it's post-Trump inauguration. We were just hoping that maybe we could have a restart on that, but no such luck. It's WBAI New York, 8 o'clock, Wednesday. It's time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
Bundle it,
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined by Kyle.
I'm joining you, yes.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Yeah, change the order. And Bernie S. down in Philadelphia, I believe?
Yes, greetings from Philadelphia.
Welcome. We have some important things to talk about tonight. We have a special guest coming in just a few minutes. But first, some updates. You guys know there are a billion Yahoo accounts still for sale? Get your checkbooks out. 1 billion Yahoo accounts, $200,000 or best offer. Now, the passwords don't work, but the dates of birth, telephone numbers, and security questions could still be useful to an adept cyber thief. That's according to this New York Times article. Now, after federal prosecutors unsealed indictments against four men they say were responsible for a 2014 intrusion into Yahoo systems that affected 500 million, that's half a billion user accounts, and basically data on 1 billion accounts stolen in another attack on the company a year earlier, appear to remain available on underground hacker forums. That's as recent as Friday. Yeah, it's just crazy to see stories like this coming by where you can go and buy information, buy accounts, even though you can't actually log into them anymore. The information that is there is still quite relevant to people who want to cause mischief, open up credit cards, buy houses, whatnot. Anybody partake in any purchasing?
No. I'm kind of wondering how much I can get for my old Yahoo account. I haven't used it in maybe 15 years. I guess what's 1/1,000,000th of that $200,000?
Yeah, well, it's just it's crazy because you do lose track of these things. I've got a Hotmail account out there someplace. I don't know where it is. I don't know the password. Somebody probably does have the password. They probably already hacked it. And I don't care. I really don't. But I don't give any real information anyway. So even if you do get whatever data I chose to give them, it's not going to do anybody any good. But I know a lot of people don't live that way.
I certainly know someone who's affected by this.
Do you?
Not me, but okay. Sure. I mean, it's still a popular enough email service.
So you're just basically asking for a friend.
Exactly. Okay, I get well, it. I mean, you know. Uh-huh. No, maybe a couple.
Do people still use Hotmail?
The thing is, like, these things do still affect people because one of the shops here in the neighborhood where the station is, there's a big sign in front saying help wanted email, and then there's an AOL.com email address.
People do use AOL. They still use AOL. The vice president uses AOL to do all his business.
Wait, these were Hotmail or Yahoo Mail?
This was Yahoo.
Okay.
All right. We're talking about the cream of the crop here. Yahoo, AOL, and Hotmail. Bernie, did you say you knew somebody with Hotmail, or do you use Hotmail yourself?
I actually have a Hotmail account. I've had it since before Microsoft purchased Hotmail, which was like back in the 90s. So, and I still use it occasionally.
Does Microsoft want to admit that they own Hotmail? Maybe people have forgotten about that.
No, they actually are trying very hard to change the brand to Outlook.com, which is their email client, Outlook.com. So my Hotmail address is still at Hotmail.com, but I can be reached by that same address at Hotmail.com. So they're trying to get rid of the Hotmail brand, but they're keeping the accounts, the address is active.
So, yeah, I don't understand this, and they probably paid $1 billion for this, but they get a bunch of email addresses that, you know, I spend all my time trying to block and not get any information from, and Microsoft goes and pays all this money, not for the Hotmail.com name, but just for the valuable information that is attached to the accounts. Is that correct?
Well, Microsoft bought Hotmail back in the 90s. I think it was around 97. Or so, 97, 98.
That's pre Google, isn't it?
It is.
And wow.
I think when they bought it, they were still trying to get the online service MSN going, and I think they were trying to tie it into that whole online experience.
That was long before MSN. Yeah, it predates a lot of stuff that we know about.
Yeah, I too had a Hotmail back then before Microsoft bought it, but I used it for a while, but it's been long since abandoned and I believe closed.
Didn't Chris Lilly play the MSN butterfly, I think, in some of those ads?
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I think he was the MSN butterfly.
Well, that's something to
fun fact
to fathom. But it's not the only thing going on in the world of hackers. In fact, Google has said that hacked websites are on the rise. I guess another way of saying that is hacked websites are making a comeback because do you remember back in the 90s, hacked websites. That was the graffiti of the internet. That was how people expressed themselves. That's how many people got the word out about Kevin Mitnick's plight and other injustices going on, both in the hacker world and in the world at large. But recently, in the last few days, actually, Google painted a bleak picture of cybersecurity, saying the number of websites hacked rose 32% last year, with little relief in sight. We don't expect this trend to slow down. As hackers get more aggressive, and we've noticed that amongst ourselves, we're getting more aggressive. You know, we can't seem to stop it.
Absolutely.
Well, don't step up to me, Kyle. I'm just saying, I'm the one speaking here.
Watch what you're pointing at,
you
buddy.
Put your finger down.
Oh, my God. Well, you guys shut up.
Who are you to intervene in this? Bernie, don't even.
Step off.
I won't.
All right.
I'll step back.
Let's take a breath. I'm sorry. We don't expect this trend to slow down. Hackers are getting more aggressive. More sites become outdated. Hackers will continue to capitalize by infecting more sites. Yes, hackers will infect more sites with our words and our images and our hacked pictures and things like that. And Google said this in a post on its webmaster blog. You guys ever read that, the webmaster blog on Google?
No.
I don't.
I might have seen it.
I didn't know it existed.
Yeah, well, now we do. Now we do. Google, which inserts security warnings when it detects hacked sites, said most of those warned can clean up their pages, but that 61% are not notified because their sites are not verified by the search engine. Okay, can anybody explain what that sentence means? 61% of websites that are insecure are not notified because Google hasn't verified them.
Does that mean they haven't, like, had an email sent back from whatever contact email address? How do you get verified by Google?
Well, it means you give them more information.
Right.
And I guess if you're not willing to do that, or if you just don't respond to them, you're not verified, and therefore you don't... It's like the mafia.
It implies some kind of interaction.
If you don't respond to us, something could happen.
Maybe even transaction.
Wow. Okay. As always... The blog continues, it's best to take a preventative approach and secure your site rather than dealing with the aftermath. That's almost exactly what I just said. It'd be a real shame if something happened to your website here. Remember, a chain is only as strong as, together?
Its weakest link.
Bernie, okay. news comes amid growing concerns over cybersecurity in the wake of massive hacks affecting Yahoo. And, of course, Yahoo's counter the U.S. government. Because when you think of Yahoo, you think of who's in charge now. Hacking behavior is constantly evolving, and research allows us to stay up to date on and combat the latest trends. And speaking of some of the mischief that's been going on, there has been a rash of pro-Turkish Twitter hacks. Now, I know Twitter is not necessarily hacking a website. It's hacking a Twitter account, which is almost as easy. In fact, it's probably easier because you can just guess a password. By the way, did anybody catch the tweet that 2600 sent out the last week where somebody was trying to guess our password? You get notified when that happens. And we basically just sent out a tweet saying, you know, whoever's trying to do this, we change our password once a day for 30 seconds to the word password. Good luck. And that became so popular. Somebody wrote a script, in fact, to keep trying until they get it. You know, maybe we're not telling the truth. So that's another thing we ought to tell people. But yeah, it's funny to see this. But that's the attitude I think you need to have, is that it's all a game. It's all funny. It's all, social media. It's IRC. It's the internet. Don't take it so seriously. I mean, take it as seriously as you need to, but let's not go overboard. And sending people to jail for hacking Twitter accounts, I think that's going way overboard. And unfortunately, we seem to be in that world. But you might have heard this because it was the lead story in all the evening newscasts, I believe. Multiple prominent Twitter accounts, including ones for Forbes, Justin Bieber, and the University of Chicago. And I hope those three things never appear in the same sentence again. They were hacked early Wednesday, not this Wednesday, last Wednesday, began sending out anti-Dutch and German messages. I think they mean anti-German messages, not a bunch of German messages that were anti-Dutch, because that's definitely not a good sign. The compromised accounts featuring a banner photo of the Turkish flag began tweeting out the same message featuring a swastika, always a way to win friends, as well as all kinds of hashtags involving Nazis and Dutch people. It wasn't immediately clear how many accounts were hacked, but prominent victims included Nike, Starbucks, the NHL Network, Duke University, and Floyd Mayweather, according to reports. I almost feel like we're left out because people can't guess our password. An account for Bieber in Japan was also attacked. So it wasn't the main, mothership Bieber account. It was a Japanese subsidiary.
How do you know that's not the main one?
It might be.
Okay.
Wow. I guess that's an account in Japan that just tweets Bieber propaganda in Japanese. I think that's the whole purpose of it. And
really well, yeah.
And apparently they don't use a strong password or good security. Anyway, a Twitter spokesman said the problem links back to a third-party app. Actually, this is how they got in, which the company blocked access to once the breach occurred. That third-party app appears to be analytics service Twitter Counter. That's according to The Guardian. Twitter Counter CEO Omer Ginar confirmed to the New York Daily News that hackers did use the app to send out the messages, and the company is investigating what happened. He said Twitter Counter doesn't store account messages, account passwords, or other sensitive information. But apparently they do have enough so that when they're compromised, your Twitter account is compromised. I'm curious how that works.
Well, it's like you said with the weakest link. It's every time it's not just Twitter's own security or your email's own security. It's every time you authorize a different app to use Twitter, which you do every time you install a new app on your phone or authorize something else to use it. This is another link in the chain, and that app is itself another thing completely outside of Twitter, completely outside of anything else that can be subverted. So, be aware of how good the apps you're using are and how much security you're giving up every time you...
It's a wake-up call, you know? If somebody figures out a way to do this using a third-party app, we all get to know about that. We all know that, hey, this is another point of entry, and I think we're more intelligent for that. So let's look at it as education. I know that's how McDonald's is looking at it. The McDonald's executives are recovering from their Twitter account being hacked and having a message that called President Trump a disgusting excuse of a president. That apparently is not the I'll read you the actual tweet here. Real Donald Trump, which is his Twitter account, you are actually a disgusting excuse of a president, and we would love to have Barack Obama back. Also, you have tiny hands. That was came directly from McDonald's, and they just want the world to know that that's not necessarily how they feel. In a statement to CBS Money Watch, because CBS Money Watch has nothing more important to talk about, McDonald's said Twitter notified us that our account was compromised. They had to be told by Twitter? Okay. We deleted the tweet, secured our account, and are now investigating this. Later in the day, McDonald's said it determined a hack was behind the tweet. It took them almost a full day to figure this out. Based on our investigation, we have, McDonald's. In case you couldn't get McDonald's the other day, they were busy doing this. We have determined that our Twitter account was hacked by an external source. It's a statement we took because they asked everybody, did anybody do this? Come on, fess up. We took swift action. No, you didn't. It was not swift. If that's swift action, I'd hate to see what your slow action is. We took swift action to secure it, and we apologize. This tweet was sent through our corporate McDonald's account. But the funny thing is that it really heightened the popularity of their Twitter account while it was there. More people were retweeting and visiting them than ever before. Publicity. They win through that.
Well, it's also peak Shamrock Shake season, so I hope this didn't interfere with that too much.
It got people's mind off that, so that's a good thing too, right?
But there is significance to it being an external hack or an external attack versus often with these branded Twitters and social media accounts, there might be some rogue employee with access who decides to do something fun with it or something like that. Somebody's last day of work and they want to go out with a bang. it's the new take this job and shove it, maybe.
Yes, absolutely. Okay, on a more serious note, though, there are things that we've been discussing here on this program over the weeks, months, years, We had a listener write in, actually, this week. On last week's Off the Hook, there was a discussion of the Electronic Frontier Foundation's guide to protecting the privacy of data that can be accessed through your devices at the U.S. border. I believe it was Emmanuel who asserted that the choices they present when agents tell you to give them access to your sensitive data are not acceptable. While the EFF has shown that they agree your privacy should be protected, they are both taking action to assert that and providing the means for us to demand it. And that is true, because this week the EFF released a news story saying that border agents need a warrant to search travelers' phones. That's according to what they have told the court. Border agents must obtain a warrant to search travelers' phones, tablets, and laptops, which contain a vast trove of sensitive, highly personal information that is protected by the Fourth Amendment. And that was told to a federal appeals court on March 20th. Now, searches of devices at the border have more than doubled since the inauguration of President Trump, from nearly 25,000 in all of 2016 to 5,000 in February alone, the shortest month, 5,000 in February alone. You do the math on that, you get over 60,000 in a year. That would be well over double if it continued, and it's probably going to increase. Now, along with the increasing number of people who carry devices when they travel, this increases heightened awareness of the need for stronger privacy rights while crossing the U.S. border. Now, while the Fourth Amendment ordinarily requires law enforcement officials to get a warrant supported by probable cause before searching our property, in cases that predate the rise of digital devices, courts granted border agents the power to search our luggage without a warrant or any suspicion of wrongdoing. And we all kind of accept that. You know, we know when we go across borders, it's quite likely that you will be searched without a warrant.
And I think why this is a good reminder is that it shouldn't be normalized in any way for electronic devices, just because and we get lulled into believing that by talking tough about immigration and all this stuff, that somehow this and having these high profile, like the Apple case in San Bernardino with regard to people's phones, it gives the public the impression that this is vital, and thus the people who are agents on the ground then feel emboldened and almost obligated to do this stuff.
Well, that is true, and I guess the idea here is to less embolden them by saying that portable digital devices differ wildly from luggage, not the same thing, and that's kind of what we were talking about last week. People are being told that you can try to fight it, but you're going to lose your device forever, and you'll be held up for hours, if not longer, at the border. So the best way to deal with this is simply to encrypt things or not have things on your devices in the first place. I like this approach better because it's more aggressive. It's more fighting to preserve our rights. They're saying that, yes, the portable digital devices differ wildly from luggage or other physical items that we carry with us to the airport because they provide access to the entirety of our private lives. And that's EFF saying this in an amicus brief that was filed at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fourth Circuit in the border search case U.S. versus Colsus. In 2014, the Supreme Court noted that cell phones now hold the privacies of life for people, including highly personal private information such as photos, text, contact list, email messages, and videos. Many digital devices can access personal records stored in the cloud, such as financial or medical information. Before smartphones were invented, that kind of information would be kept in our home offices, in our desk drawers, or in our basement storage. If law enforcement officers wanted to enter your home or lockbox as part of a search, they would need to go before a judge, prove probable cause that you're involved in the crime, and get a warrant. The border is not a constitution-free zone, said Adam Schwartz, EFF senior staff attorney. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled in 2014 that mobile phones are a window into our private lives, and police need to show there's probable cause that the people they arrest have committed crimes and obtain a warrant to search their phones. There should be no less protection for individuals who have not been arrested or shown to have committed any crime, but who instead simply want to enter the United States or return to their country. So let's hope that this is listened to, that this is something that's taken seriously, because I don't think there are many more important rights that we have. It's the right to our privacy. and to not be searched, and to be told that when you're at the border, those rules no longer apply, and you just got to submit to everything, or take extra precautions to encrypt and protect. I think we're better off fighting the notion that we should even consider giving up that right.
Yeah, I think if it becomes implicit that that's the case, even though it's not said explicitly, it can then be used to actually have misinformation at the border and amongst citizens who maybe aren't following this as much or haven't traveled as much. It may lead to them being kind of led to believe, duped into this in a time when you're vulnerable. You don't have access to all your things, maybe your lawyer necessarily, and you get sort of isolated, and you're at their mercy in sort of pseudo custody.
Emmanuel,
go ahead, Bernie.
Oh, I just wanted to say we've all been saying we shouldn't normalize. We shouldn't allow our government to normalize the searching of our mobile devices. But the only way to do that is to just say no. And, you know, you don't have to be rude about it when a Customs and Borders Protection agent says, give us your cell phone and your password. You can just politely decline and say, no, I'm sorry. Either you can say you don't remember it or no, thank you, sort of thing. If you're nasty, they're going to be nasty back to you. But if everybody does that, or if a lot of people just politely decline, then they can't keep you from entering the country. You're an American citizen. So, and that is your property, that phone. So I think they can hold you, maybe even for a day or two, but you can't be compelled to provide your access to the contents of your cell phone by giving up your password or whatever. They can't do it. You can just say no. Yeah, and that's what people need to do.
And the big thing about this is, like, when you're stopped at the border and there are officers there and they're armed and you're faced with, I just want to get back into my country, that's mm-hmm. That's one of the most vulnerable positions you can be in as a citizen.
Yep.
And it's very scary. Even if you know what your rights are, even if you know the law backwards and forwards, that's a scary thing to have happen. And mm-hmm. It's not easy for anyone. And people are very likely in that position, I think, in general, to just go along with it, to just go ahead with it and say, yeah, you can do what you want. You can look what you want. Look at what you want. Just let me back into my damn country. And that's how these things get normalized. It's the slow creep. And once you give up rights, it's very, very difficult to ever get them back.
And indeed. And so let's remind them. And as Bernie said, that through that, we can reiterate that these rights do apply, and educate one another to not be intimidated about this, and approach it through the law and what citizens are entitled to under search and seizure and other provisions, and make sure that stuff's actually followed.
And of course, the enforcement of these things tends to, in practice, vary with say what you look like, what you seem to be doing with yourself. It's very arbitrary what may or may not be done to you by authority figures. And
think about the room for corruption that then sort of opens up in a lot of ways too, and on and on.
Absolutely. It's a really twisted state of affairs right now. I think now more than ever, and it behooves all of us to not only be aware of what we can do to keep things on a more sane level, but the fact that this is even a fight that's going on.
Okay, I have a confession here to make, guys. I've been off mic for a few minutes here. I've been trying to reach our guest, and the number I'm calling is busy. But I realize after playing with the phone a little bit that every number I call in 212 is busy, a 212 area code. And I'm not sure why that is. We've got a phone here. I'm dialing 9 to get an outside line. You don't have to dial 9?
You don't have to dial 9.
But you get another dial tone when you dial 9. Listen. This is what I'm doing. Here's a dial tone, right? Okay, I dial 9, and I get a dial tone. I'm not supposed to do that?
That's very strange.
So I'm supposed to just dial the number without a 9?
Yeah, try that.
All right, I'll try that. You guys keep talking.
Okay. Well, we could move on to another story that that's been going around this week. Bernie, you sent this in to us. This is yesterday on Gizmodo. A grand jury just called tweeting an animated GIF assault with a deadly weapon.
Was this the flashing GIF that caused a seizure? Somebody said you deserve a seizure.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. There is a Newsweek journalist named Kurt Eichenwald.
Hang on, I'm back. Just to update you, as soon as I dial a single number, I get a fast busy, so that doesn't work.
That's strange.
I got to keep trying this.
On the other line, I use try maybe.
I'm using line 12. Shall I use a different line? Is that the wrong line to use?
I think that's the wrong line to use. Try one.
One? Okay. No one told me this. All right. Never mind.
but yes, it's a Newsweek journalist called Kurt Eichenwald who is an epileptic and someone tweeted this GIF at him, and then along with comments, let's see if he has a seizure, I hope he dies, that sort of thing. And this was a person from Maryland, and a Texas grand jury charged him with aggravated assault with a deadly weapon, the deadly weapon being the GIF file. So this is a very interesting case. I don't think there's an easy answer to this one. On the one hand, it can seem ludicrous to call a digital file a deadly weapon. On the other hand, if you know somebody suffers a certain condition and you
exasperated,
you tailor your attack to that specific thing. I mean, anything's a deadly weapon if you use it to attack someone. Mm-hmm. So this is a really interesting case, but it also brings up the info that or the concept that if you do suffer from certain medical conditions that can be exacerbated by things like this, most browsers and apps nowadays can disable the animation features for you.
Okay, we've solved the problem. We have our guest on the line, and I'm really sorry about this. Marika Hirose, am I pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes.
From the New York Civil Liberties Union is on the phone with us right now and joining us over a very important topic that we've talked about in the past. In fact, Marika, you and another panelist whose name escapes me at the moment were at the Hope Conference.
Benjamin Dean. Yeah,
it was one of the most interesting talks I think at the Hope Conference, all about these Link NYC kiosks that are popping up all over the place, and the potential privacy issues that these gigantic creatures are posing for citizens of New York. So, Marika, let me ask you to outline what some of those privacy threats were.
Sure. So, when we first started seeing the rollout of Link NYC and we checked the privacy policies, we were concerned because we saw that the policy very broadly allowed collection and retention of data without specific data retention periods and without specific strong assurances about people getting noticed if there are requests for that data from government agencies. We also had some questions about the cameras and the environmental sensors on these devices and exactly what the purpose and the limits of these cameras and environmental sensors were.
I know at the time of the talk, the cameras were not in use. Do you know if the cameras have been turned on since then?
I don't know. I think I saw some announcement that they either are or will be soon. And with the limitations that appear in the new privacy policy that was issued recently.
Which you guys are largely responsible for. We were talking to the city trying to get them to strengthen the Wi-Fi privacy policy and just pay attention to other things that a lot of people would not have known about otherwise. Can you tell us what was significant that happened in the last few days?
Sure. Yes. Yeah. So the city and CityBridge, which is the company behind Link NYC, announced an updated privacy policy that greatly strengthens the privacy protections and responds to the concerns that we had raised last year with the some of the issues around the collection and retention of data and notice of request for information.
Interesting. Are you satisfied with the response that you've gotten up to this point?
Yeah, we're really excited that the city and the company were responsive to our concerns and took our concerns seriously. And we think that this is the model of listening to community needs and concerns about privacy from the public is a really good and important one for municipal Wi-Fi projects.
Well, from what I understand, what is in their privacy policy, first of all, you learn this from the talk. If you watch the talk, which I highly recommend, you learn that when you initially clicked on their privacy policy, it sounded so good. You know, we will never sell your name to anybody. And it seemed like they really cared about people's privacy. But when you really looked into it, they were talking about the privacy policy for their website, not for their actual machines. Is that correct?
It was a little confusing, and I think it was Benjamin who pointed it out, that there were two privacy policies, one for the website and one for the link devices, and it could be a little confusing which one you were looking at.
Yes. I don't know if that was intentional. And a question I had, though, because I learned so much just by watching this, they have something known as beacons inside these devices, and beacons... they send out signals to other devices. They're contacting you. Do you know when beacons are used and what their purpose is?
So that is in the policy around the collection of information and receiving certain communications. There are parts of the policies that are strong in the sense of they say that they don't sell your information. And that's the part that we had focused on were just the general collection and retention of data, which we were pleased by the policies, the new policy changes, because it limited that retention period from what it was previously.
Interesting.
Emmanuel?
Go ahead, Bernie.
Hi, Mariko. This is Bernie.
Hi.
S. I just wanted to enlighten our listeners. If not everybody knows what we're talking about, we're talking about these big kiosks you see in Manhattan. I guess they're just in Manhattan, right? That's the only borough they're in right now?
No, they're in other boroughs as well. They're starting to roll them out everywhere.
These are these big monoliths. It kind of looked like from the movie 2001, although they're not as big and they're not completely black, that have replaced the payphone booths. And for our listeners who aren't aware of this, these things are replacing the payphones, and you can make telephone calls on them, but they're also basically spying on everybody who walks by with a cell phone. If your cell phone's Wi-Fi or Bluetooth is turned on, and frankly, just if your face is turned on because there's cameras on these.
Right, phones, yes.
These new payphone booths are basically spying on everybody that's standing near them or walking by them, and that's what we're talking about. And there's how many thousands of these things are there in New York City right now, Mariko?
It's changing every day. I see them crop up all over the place. I think they just came into my neighborhood a couple weeks ago. So they're going to be in a lot of places.
It's like City Bike, only they're watching everything you do. Mariko, there are sensors on these things. How many different sensors are on each one?
There are environmental sensors, and one of the things we had asked for was to make clear what kinds of sensors we're talking about. So the new privacy policy talks about temperature sensors, humidity, ambient noise, light pressure, and air pollutants.
Ambient noise, does that mean these things are always listening?
Well, they're collecting some form of ambient noise around the around these devices.
That's scary. And you know, I know people
require microphones. That means that there's microphones.
Yeah, there obviously are. But, you know, people say this is a free service. You have no right to complain. But you do. You do because you may not be a customer. You're definitely a product. And you are at risk of losing a whole lot of privacy to something like this.
And also, if you're not a customer of the service, you're also still subject to having whatever you say as you walk past the thing, pictures of your face. You didn't agree to any of that because you're not a customer, but it's still out there.
I think the important thing in every project like this is to think about what data is being collected and retained and shared, and for what purpose, and if it's necessary for the purpose of providing the service, and whether that whole model is something that the community wants. This exercise was helpful because the city and City Bridge did take into account our concerns about the privacy policy. And going forward with these kinds of projects, it's really important that we have more open conversations and more channels for expressing concerns as early in the process as possible.
So is it through these changes, is it your opinion that the policy changes a little bit more, the language is a little bit more upfront about the cost of this service, or have they changed their model as far as doing that kind of third-party selling of private data?
Well, the language is definitely clearer in this version, and it clarifies certain items that we cared a lot about, including that browsing history from personal devices or that kind of information is not going to be stored, that most technical information is going to be deleted after a certain period of time, that there will be notice given through an email address, if they have an email address for you, of any requests for information. And then certain limits on camera use. So these are our changes that clarify the scope of what these links, these structures are doing. When we first expressed our concerns, some of the public response that we got from the company was that they were not doing any of these things, that any of these collection of data that we were concerned about, but the policy was so broadly written that it would have allowed the company to collect that information. So this new policy is stronger in that it strengthened and tightened the language and made sure that the company can't collect and retain more information than what the privacy policy allows without giving the public notice.
Well, Marika, I think the entire city owes you guys at the New York Civil Liberties Union a huge debt for tackling this, for pointing this out, because it easily could have just gone without any challenge whatsoever, and we could be facing a tremendous infringement of our privacies as we simply walk down the street. Is there anything the public can do to help out in this particular case?
I think it's always helpful, and it was very helpful that the public was very interested in what we were doing last year after we pointed out some of these concerns. And I know that a lot of people attended our panel during the conference and also expressed concerns. So public interest and watching what the government is doing, reading the privacy policies. I know that's something that a lot of us don't do frequently, mm-hmm. but
yes.
If people can read the privacy policies and express the concerns that they have, that public conversation is very helpful for advancing all of our privacy interests.
If somebody out there in the community just reads the privacy policy and tells the rest of us what it says, that alone is helpful. But yes, it's important to know what's in there, because initially, like we said, it would just guide you to a web page policy, and a lot of people didn't think it went any further than that, and you guys were able to figure out that it sure did. Bernie, Marika? Did you have something? Go ahead.
Yeah, Marika, I know you don't have much time left, but I wanted to ask you what our listeners and anybody else, frankly, who really care about this important mm-hmm. issue can do to help the NYCLU, the New York Civil Liberties Union, continue this important work. I understand NYCLU is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, mm-hmm. that relies on donors to continue this legal work that you're doing that's so important. How can people get involved and help NYCLU keep doing this work?
What a great setup and pitch. Thank you. People can definitely come to our visit our website and become a member, donate to us. You can also follow our work. We have email lists and other newsletters that will keep you informed about what we're doing. And we'd also love to just hear from you about what you care about, anything that you find concerning. I know a lot of people listening are interested in these privacy and technology issues and may have the expertise to notice concerns that you would want to report. So we are looking forward to working with, we always work with advocates and others who are paying attention to these issues.
And of course, that website is nyclu.org. And Marika, let me just ask you one more question. If you join the ACLU, is that different from joining the NYCLU?
The NYCLU is a New York affiliate of the ACLU. So we do specifically work within New York State, but we are the state-level organization for the American Civil Liberties Union.
I see. So if you join one, are you joining the other, or should you specifically go to nyclu.org and join there?
Yes, you are joining us, but if you want to follow specifically our work in New York, you should follow our email e-newsletters.
Okay. Well, I hope lots of people do, because the work you do is simply incredible and valuable to everybody in the city and surrounding regions. We're speaking with Marika Hirose from the New York Civil Liberties Union, senior staff attorney. And thank you again for everything you've done. And I hope we see more success in the future.
Thank you for having me.
Good night.
Good night.
Well, that was enlightening.
Very much so. And on the point of the terms of service being unreadable and confusing,
mm-hmm.
I've been handed something from one of our field reporters on the ground. There's a site called Terms of Service Didn't Read.
We have field reporters on the ground?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. I thought they were all in the field, but okay, fine.
Our anonymous field reporter on the ground, who is Voltaire, he handed me the website TOSDR.org. It stands for Terms of Service Didn't Read, and it's a community project to analyze the terms of service of various sites and services out there, break them down into plain English, rate them positive or negative. Are they helpful to the user? Are they detrimental? And it's a very interesting project, a very interesting site, and they've got browser add-ons and things. So yeah, check it out, TOSDR.org.
TOSDR.org. Well, that's great. That's exactly what I was asking about. Thank you. And thank you to Voltaire. We want to take some listener phone calls. You know what? Someone's already calling into our one phone line, but we didn't ask you to do that. And yeah, the issue is that I don't know why you're calling. You know, it could be a bill collector. We have a lot of those calling us. So we're not going to take that call. We can't, because we didn't ask for the call, all right? Our phone number, we're going to give out the phone number as soon as you hang up. We can't take that call. We can't. So please hang up. Our phone number is 347-335-0818. And how do I know that this person hung up and it's not another person? You know, what I have to do is I'm going to have to pick up and hang up. I'm going to do that. It's nasty, but what else can I do? There's no option.
I think your course of action is clear.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you guys keep talking while I.
I'm good do that. With it. I'm okay with this. Yeah.
I support you in this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still looking at Terms of Service Didn't Read. It was founded by a hacktivist called Hugo Roy.
I hung up on him. Sorry.
Wow. So yeah, give us a call, 347-335-0818.
We'd like to hear from you.
Yeah, and that's a real area code, 347. I know it sounds funny, but it's real. And now the phone's ringing again. Did you want to finish what you were reading, and I'll go to this phone call?
I think we can go to the phone call.
Okay. Again, 347-335-0818. If you want to hear a busy signal right now, you can call that number. Hear what I was hearing when I was calling any number on the other line, which apparently is just there to fool me. Let's take a phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hi. Guess who I am? I'm the last living person who's been using Windows XP.
Oh, no, you're not.
And
it's not true.
You're okay.
It's not true.
And the thing is, my computer caught a virus recently, mm-hmm. and this is like kind of serious. And so I have Verizon's, what's called Verizon Premium Technical Support, and it seems like each technician you get has a different opinion about viruses because they wiped out the virus, and then when I went back on the internet, I caught the virus, seemed like the same one again. So here's what I'd like to ask you. I have a new computer that I'm going to transfer files to. So this is like a two-part question, please. The first part is, I'm going to transfer files from the old computer now that the virus has been knocked out again, but I'm afraid about transferring files and transferring the virus. Now, one computer technician today at Verizon said, if you use a thumb drive and you transfer the files to the thumb drive and then put the thumb drive into the new computer, chances are you will not transmit the virus. Meanwhile, another, I've been using AVG free, by the way, and another technician said most viruses tend to hide in like the My Documents section. So I'd like to ask, the first question is, how do you do a file? I mean, I'm really not a computer person. You'll probably hear it in my voice. How do you do a file transfer from one computer to another without infecting the new computer?
Okay, well, first of all, you may not be a computer person, but we're not the computer show.
I figured you were the guys to ask.
We might know a thing or two about it, but it's not really our main expertise. The show after us does, but it's on tape, so you're going to have a hard time asking them as well. But what my general advice would be probably things you've already done is running files through a virus scanner and trying to make sure they're clean in that way. As far as ensuring that you don't actually copy over a virus to another machine, one sure way to do that is to go to a different operating system. For instance, if you copied all of your files over to a Mac or a Unix system or something like that, at least you would know that the files that you could open there, not the executable files, they are clean if you can look at them there. That's the only thing I can really come up with off the top of my head.
Yeah, and also on the new computer, which I'm guessing has up-to-date virus software of any flavor, whatever you've got. If it's a good virus software with updated definitions and such, every time you put your USB in with files you're transferring over, just scan the USB first before
yes.
you copy everything.
Because if that's corrupted, then that could be the explanation there too.
Yeah, or buy a. A small hard drive that connects via USB, if your old computer has USB, that, you know, is sufficiently large enough to copy, say, your entire file system. But we don't want to get into the specifics of how big or small your equipment is.
Detective work is always good. Like, if you can, say, copy a little bit of your system over and then see if it gets infected, then you know that the infection is isolated to the little bit that you copied over. Then if that works out for a few days, copy more and see, you know, try to make it happen. Try to see when it gets triggered, and then maybe you'll be able to find the culprit and just isolate that. That's really the best we can offer.
Have you ever seen, when you're in Word, a little extra dot by your cursor? Is that a sign of a virus when you have a tiny little dot wherever your cursor is?
I seriously doubt that. Bernie, you seem pretty adamant about that.
No, that's like if you hear a click on your telephone line, you must be subject to a wire tap.
No, Bernie, if you don't hear a click, that means you're being tapped.
Probably.
Yeah, that's what it means. Rob, what do you have?
Also, for anyone looking for tips like this, our friends at the PC Radio Show pre-record their show now, but you can still email them through their website, which is pcradioshow.com. You can email the show, and they can answer
and,
your questions.
And, sir, you'll get much better responses if you do that. What's that email address one more time?
I don't have the email address in front of me, but the website is pcradioshow.com, and there's a Contact Us page.
All right. Well, good luck to you on that. We're going to open up the phone lines to someone else. And, again, our phone number is 347-335-0818. Now, I've had experiences, though, with these virus scanners, and some of them are so annoying. First of all, they eat up memory, and they're invasive, and they keep opening when you don't want them to. And one thing that I find super annoying is their assumption of what a virus is. Remember the Melissa virus many years ago? Well, it turns out that if you have a file on your system called Melissa, it assumes it's a virus and erases it. I've had virus scanners do that. Or, you know, we having a Hacker magazine, we have articles that have code in them and refer to certain things, and they are labeled as suspect and either isolated or deleted without any confirmation. Those are the kinds of virus scanners you shouldn't get. And there are many of those out there. So just be forewarned and be careful. Let's take another phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. How are you?
Hi. What's on your mind?
Oh, yeah. You don't have much time.
No.
I might understand from your last guest, who I don't want to mispronounce the name, that the new phone booths that are coming out actually hear what you say when you're walking by.
Well, we don't really know. We don't really know for sure that they record ambient noise. It might be doing that.
We don't know the exact specification and at what distance, so like what the proximity of whatever ambient microphone is equipped with it, if it's separate from what you use to make phone calls or if it's that same microphone. We don't know how far away or how clear any of that would be or how much of it there is.
I guarantee you the NYPD is very interested in this as well. And if it is recording what you're saying as you walk by, you will see prosecutions based on intercepted conversations.
Oh, I have some, I'll just say it. Don't keep your cell phone, especially with apps, in your front pocket.
Okay, why?
Reproductive damage.
Okay. All right. Well, it's good advice. Well taken. Thanks for the call.
Yes. Be mindful of your soft tissue.
I'm not really sure what it has to do with Link NYC, but it's best to be forewarned. Let's take another phone call. And good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Hey, it's Delcini. I'm calling live from the Privacy Board meeting. And we have a quick announcement. We have an event coming up regarding privacy on the steps of City Hall on May 17th at 11 o'clock. We have the steps reserved, and we're looking for a big turnout for that. So this is a save the date, and we're going to provide more information next week.
And do you have a website?
No, not right now, but that'll all be shared.
Okay. All right. Well, good luck with that. And
okay, thanks.
We look forward to updates. Privacy on the steps of City Hall. That's a good idea. 347-335-0818 is our phone number. We're taking phone calls only for a minute or two more, and then we have to get on out of here. But, you know, as far as Link NYC, I think we should be experimenting with these devices as much as possible. The very first thing I did, and Kyle, you were with me when I walked up to one.
Yes, I witnessed this.
I made a phone call to my cell phone. And held it up to the speaker and started creating this amazingly loud feedback loop.
It got really, really high pitch, and we started shouting into it, and it was magnificent.
Yeah, it didn't really prove anything, but
it was entertaining.
It's experimentation. You got to experiment, and you know, let's see what these things are doing and can do, and that's what any device should be used for, is experimentation. Let's take one more phone call. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Go ahead.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Dan. Long time listener, first time caller. We're talking about Link NYC, right?
Yes.
So can you hit me with the question one more time? I kind of got lost with everyone talking.
We didn't really have a question.
It's just opinion?
Yeah, we're basically brainstorming.
Okay, and the topic is giving out cell phones to people in NYC?
Have you used one of these devices?
No, my mom was eligible for one. I never used it, though.
Okay, I'm not sure we're talking about the same thing. Link NYC are the big monolithic devices where payphones used to be, where you can make free phone calls.
You can charge your phone and your mobile device.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Yeah, they're probably
the modern day era of the payphone, man. I mean, you know, they're good at keeping up with the times. I don't see too many other than in Midtown and in Kips Bay, Murray Hill area. I don't know if they have them too much in the outer boroughs, but I think it's a good step towards, offering something of use in today's age to the public.
I agree with that totally. It's a good thing to give people internet access, the ability to make free phone calls,
free Wi-Fi.
But nothing is free, especially the things that don't cost anything. Sometimes they're more expensive than anything. What we mean by that is that they can invade your privacy. They can keep track of the websites you visit. They can keep track of what you do with your phone, copy your information and store it and use it against you if you're ever questioned for anything. It can record people as they walk by, both with video and with audio. So we just need to know what these things are doing before we accept them in our communities.
How many times do people usually know what they're signing up for before they hit agree to any terms on an app or anything that we use day to day that we take granted for? You know, our privacy is something that we don't even know if we have anymore.
That's very true. That's very true. And I think those are very wise words to end on.
Yeah, that's why we're saying, you know, realize what you're using and protect yourself if you're using it. And, you know, do that for your community as well with how you set up and interface with it.
Okay, we are out of time. I want to thank people for calling in and participating. And, of course, I want to thank Mariko from the NYCLU for all the hard work she has done and all the hard work they are doing. We will be back next week. Our email address, oth@2600.com. Good night. Last night I took a walk in the dark to a place called Palisade Park. That's a friend who sees what I can see. That's where the girls are. I took a ride on the ship to shoot. The girl I said the top was on the key. I want to stop shooting cold.
Thursday, March 23rd at 10 p.m., join the Sweet Spot as we host Renaissance Dance Music impresario, Bill Coleman. From Billboard magazine editor to label owner, this DJ producer has worked with just about everybody in dance music, playing seminal roles in the careers of D-Light, Ultranate, and many others. Not to mention, he's also an occasional member of Jody Watley's touring band. Catch up with this legendary tastemaker as he plays a few songs from the soundtrack of his life. Only on The Sweet Spot, this Thursday, March 23rd at 10 p.m. WBAI 99.5 FM, listener-sponsored community radio.
My fellow Americans, this is the spirit of Richard Nixon. As you know, I was never a fan of WBAI. In fact, I had Hoover try to shut the place down, but the Constitution got in the way. But I've seen the light, actually a very hot eternal fire. And to be honest, I don't like this thug Trump any more than you do. Therefore, I urge listeners to support this station, because the devil, and make no mistake about it, is out to get it. Trust me. So do the right thing and donate now at give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org. And don't be surprised if you find yourself yearning for the good old days of Tricky Dick Nixon.
Hi, this is Donovan, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original personal computer radio show. I'm Hank Key. Joining me this evening is Joe King on remote. We can also be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet and on WBAI, 99.5 FM radio in New York, and WBAI.org live streaming on the Internet at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. AT&T's mobile subscribers in some U.S. states were not able to make 911 emergency calls last Wednesday, leading to many complaints from police departments and emergency agencies in various parts of the country. The FCC received these reports of widespread AT&T 911 call outages, and they are investigating. Mobile users in at least 14 states and Washington, D.C. were not able to call 911 for a few hours last Wednesday night, as reported by the New York Times. The FCC has previously fined service providers for outages. In July 2015, for example, the agency reached a $17.5 million settlement with T-Mobile USA, resolving an investigation into two separate but related 9/11 service outages that occurred on the company's national network in 2014, and together lasted nearly 3 hours, preventing T-Mobile customers from reaching first responders when making wireless 9/11 calls. The outage on Wednesday will likely give momentum to plans to upgrade the current 911 system to a next-generation 911 system that will allow people reporting emergencies to send text messages and video and images when reporting an emergency. My recommendation, at least for now, put the non-911 numbers that you would normally use for a local emergency into your cell phone in case it happens again. There's a police department, fire department, hospital, and anyone else you can think of. The FBI has a number of paid informants. Some of these informants apparently work at Best Buy, Geek Squad by day, government informants by, well, almost by day. According to court records, a Geek Squad technician was an FBI informant. He reported he had accidentally located on a computer to be repaired child pornography. He notified his boss, also an FBI informant, who alerted another FBI informant at Best Buy as well as the FBI that this occurred. The images met the definition of child pornography and was tied to a series of illicit pictures known as the Jenny. Not necessarily a problem considering companies performing computer electronic device repairs are legally required to report and if they discover child porn to law enforcement. The difference here is the paycheck. This Geek Squad member had been paid $500 for digging around the customer's computers and reporting his findings to the FBI. That changes the motivation from legal obligation to a chance to earn extra cash by digging around in files, not essentially to the repair work at hand. More of a problem is the FBI's tactic. While it possibly could have simply pointed to the legal obligation that Best Buy has to report discovered child porn, it proactively destroyed this argument by apparently trying to cover up the origin of the investigation as well as a couple of warrantless searches. Setting aside the issue of whether the search of the computer constituted an illegal search by private individuals acting as government agents, the FBI undertook a series of dishonest measures in hopes of building a case, according to defense attorney. Searches of the computer were conducted without obtaining necessary warrants. Private searches are acceptable, but the introduction of cash payments, as well as the FBI having an official liaison with Best Buy, suggests that the searches aren't really private. Instead, the FBI appears to be using private searches to route around warrant requirements. That's not permissible, and even the FBI's belief that going after the worst of the worst isn't going to be enough to salvage these warrantless searches. In addition to these problems, the file discovered by the Best Buy tech was in unallocated spaces. In other words, it was not in the directory, something that points to almost nothing legally speaking. The Jenny images were found on unallocated trash space. In other words, it can be argued that a company's owner wouldn't know of its existence and that it could have been planted there by malware. A federal appellate court unequivocally declared in February 2011 that pictures found on unallocated space did not constitute knowing possession because it is impossible to determine when, where, and who downloaded them. Courts have shown an often excessive amount of empathy for the government's outrageous behavior when pursuing criminals. The fact that there's child porn involved, well, it kind of moves the needle in the government's direction. But the obstacles that the FBI has placed in its own way through its deceptive behavior may prevent it from having a case. The case is already on shaky ground with the presiding judge questioning agents, noting that several discrepancies between FBI reports and its testimony and the perplexing opposition to turning over documents to the defense as requested. In any event, it appears the FBI has a vast network of informants, paid or otherwise, working for both private companies and the federal government. Considering the FBI is already the beneficiary of legal reporting requirements, this move seems ill-advised. It jeopardizes the legitimacy of the evidence even before the FBI engages in self-sabotaging acts it appears to have done it here. Beneath all this perplexing and disturbing aversion to adhering to the Fourth Amendment, we've seen time and time again from law enforcement agencies, both local and federal levels, anything that can be done to avoid seeking a warrant, anything that leaves a paper trail behind, is deployed to make sure that the accused faces an even more uphill battle once they arrive in court. Would the Geek Squad tech really become FBI informants on their own? I understand your sentiment, but I also don't buy it. If, as reported, the Geek Squad technicians company-wide are being rewarded with tips to the FBI, then it had to be coordinated by management. The FBI sure isn't going to go store-to-store with a massive chain like Best Buy, and I really doubt the techs would jeopardize their jobs by acting as informants. Well, we've talked about the need to back up sensitive and critical information, but there's another aspect that really has no absolute answer. You have sensitive and critical information on your device, and it does not start up. You need to send it out for repair. For most people, taking the device with sensitive or critical information from the unit is not an option. When we say device, it could be a computer, tablet, cell phone, or even certain peripherals. When equipment is repaired by the manufacturer or at a local computer repair shop, all your data on the device is fully exposed.
You know, Hank, you make a very good point about having, you know, a lot of personal and private stuff on my computer. I think it was last year, maybe a little bit before then, I called up my favorite repair service, that was 4G downtown, and I told them that I was having a bit of problem with the computer, and I thought it was memory, but I wasn't sure. Could they pick it up and run some diagnostics for me and give me an estimate on fixing it or replacing parts or whatever was necessary? And they said they would be happy to do that, and we made an appointment for them to come up and pick it up. And right before they got up here, I being very well aware of the problems that might be with giving my banking data and tax data and personal health data out to a service place, I removed the hard disk, and they came up and picked up the machine. Next morning, I got a call from them and said, there's no hard disk in the machine. I said, yeah, I know. I, I, I pulled it out for privacy reasons. Just put in one of the ones that you've got down there and test out the system for me. They called me back about an hour later and said, it tests out absolutely fine, no problem at all. And I suddenly realized I was being really stupid because the problem probably had to do with something on my hard disk. And did it mean my whole hard disk was dead? Just the data was dead? Now I had to start doing a whole bunch of work myself. You know, Hank, if I had followed your advice in setting up the machine in the first place, putting all of my data on a secondary drive, I would have had a very simple job there instead of a very complicated one. Now I had to clean off the hard disk, save all the material I wanted to save, try it again, replace the hard disk, replace memory. I can't tell you how much trouble I went through, not to mention that.